Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. Americans are charged with kidnapping in Haiti. They were only trying to save the children. We'll explain the difference between 5.7% and 2.3%. Apparently they don't understand that on Fox. Tonight we'll keep the promise we made last week that we didn't keep last week to discuss filibusters and cloture and to talk about 1975. No music yet, but we're working on it. A conservative group is targeting Newt Gingrich. And be glad it doesn't happen to you. In New York, a woman gets a ticket for having a dummy in the passenger seat. Mr. and Mrs. American, all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. All of that, news of the weird, a great guest by the name of Rosella Ryan, who is an author and a veteran of the wars over the Bay Area Rapid Transit System. She's written a book called Life as a Pinata. You'll be upset later if you don't listen to her, so stick around. Later we'll have our endpoint essay on the subject of Don't Ask. But first, that cup of coffee feels so great in your hands. The aroma goes right to the brain as you breathe it in. The cabin's warming up for the family because you had the foresight to get the fireplace going, and now the smell of that wood is mixing with your coffee. It took time and work to get to the point that you could just get up and go to the cabin whenever you wanted to, but it also took being smart. You were smart enough, for example, to know that if you're in business and have a website, you're not really in business unless you're also blogging. You went to jeffonblogging.blogspot.com and chose Blog Wizardry to write your blogs for you. It was inexpensive, it was well done, and it increased traffic to your website and your company. Even though the cabin's getting nice and toasty, you can hear the wind blowing through the trees and get a sense of the brisk outside air. What was that noise? You go to the window. A doe and her fawn. It's going to be a good day. Blog Wizardry. jeffonblogging.blogspot.com. We are going to cover all of the subjects we talked about earlier, if there's time. and in about 27 minutes or so, we're going to be joined by Rosella Ryan, as mentioned. A program note, next week we're having a guest on the subject of the John Kennedy assassination. So for those of you who are interested in that, you may want to tune in next week as well. Wanted to talk about the headlines we began with. There were 10 Americans who have been charged in Haiti with kidnapping. They were trying to take some Haitian children to the Dominican Republic, which is on the same island as is Haiti, just across the border. And the Dominican Republic is much better off. You've probably become aware of all this if you weren't before, that Haiti and the Dominican Republic occupy the same island. Haiti is extremely poor, and the Dominican Republic does pretty well. All kinds of historical reasons for that. But these folks, a group of Baptists, were carrying these children across, attempting to carry the children across the border. There were a couple of issues, however, and they were charged with kidnapping. One issue is that apparently some of those children who they thought they were moving, or I don't know what they thought, but who ostensibly they were moving because the children were left orphaned by the earthquake. Turns out that some of those kids have living parents. So that was one problem. The other problem is that this group works on saving children in two senses. One is to save them from the devastation, which is certainly salutary, and the other one is to save them religiously. They're going to bring them to Christ. So that was their goal. And of course, many of the people in Haiti are not Christian, but that apparently didn't matter that much to the group of people if what they're being charged with is in fact valid. One of the things I failed to mention at the beginning of the show is that we do have the capacity to take phone calls. So if you'd like to join us to talk about any of the topics that are currently in the news, either that we've mentioned or haven't, you're welcome to call in and join us at 347-994-3796. And you can either join us now or after Rosella joins us. The economy. The last quarter the gross domestic product increased by 5.7%. Now, this was the second quarter in a row in which we had growth in the gross domestic product. That means technically there's no more recession. The recession's over, and unless you're unemployed or afraid of becoming unemployed, things are good or getting better anyway. But the growth in that quarter was 5.7%. Fox News, among others, said, yeah, but a lot of that was because of the cash for clunkers. And the real growth rate was only 2.3%, and that's no big deal. Well, here's what the reality is. Now that you've heard the propaganda, here's what the truth is. A couple of things. First off, if the cash for clunkers program caused growth in the economy, that means it worked. Congratulations, President Obama. Congratulations, Congress. That's what the people on Fox News and elsewhere should be saying, that the stimulus program, and specifically the cash for clunkers, which was passed by the Congress, not just by Democratic votes, by the way, and signed by the president, generated a level of growth that we haven't seen. Recession is negative growth, that is a contraction in the gross domestic product for two quarters in a row. And the what's called recovery or growth is increases in the gross domestic product for two quarters in a row or more. So, like I said, the recession is technically over. And the fact that the real growth, if that's true, was only 2.3% is not a bad thing. Most economists will tell you that anything above a rate of 2 to 3%. 2 to 3% is considered perfect. It's the Goldilocks growth level. It's not too much. It's not too little. It's just right. And an underlying rate of 2.3% is wonderful. And if we could sustain that every quarter for time from now to infinity, it would be a wonderful thing for all of us. You know, unemployment would end after a time, and you would never have a high level of unemployment again. The fact is, we won't have between 2 and 3% growth a year forever, but we will apparently have it for a little while. We had 2.2% in the prior quarter and an underlying real rate of 2.3% this quarter. Those are good things, folks. And again, unless you're unemployed or fearful of becoming so, the economy is starting to show some growth. Growth, at the risk of sounding like Gordon Gekko, is good. And as long as there is growth, people will buy more things. Businesses will borrow money to capitalize their business and buy equipment, which will create more jobs, and on and on and on. So the only thing I don't understand is why there aren't a lot more happy people as a result of that. Now, unemployment is high, and the rate, which will come out tomorrow, will show that probably it increased a touch. But that will not change until we've had growth for a while. The other thing, by the way, that is going to limit the amount of growth is what's called productivity gains. Now, when you hear that the economy has become more productive, that sounds pretty good, and it is, except if you need a job. Because what productivity gains mean is that with the same number of staff hours, businesses are producing more goods and services. Well, that's great if you're the owner of the business. And it might even be good if you're a customer of that business because it means your prices will be the same or lower. But the problem is if you're seeking a job and they're able to produce more goods or services without you, then they're not going to necessarily hire you. So that's what a productivity increase is. The problem is that productivity is increasing throughout the economy, which is one of the reasons that unemployment has been fairly stubborn and why it'll take some time to get it down to a reasonable rate. The Club for Growth is a conservative, largely Republican organization, and they are striking out at Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, no liberal he, and there's a reason behind all this. Newt Gingrich supported the Republican, whose last name I can't pronounce, in the 23rd Congressional District in New York. She's the lady who was forced to drop out when the Conservative Party candidate in New York State was essentially getting a lot of Republican support. And so she dropped out in the interest of unity, and initially at least, and most of the Republicans voted for the guy who was actually a member of the Conservative Party and not nominally a Republican. He lost to a Democrat. So at present, Gingrich was supporting, and at the moment I just lost what state he's in, but the senatorial candidate is Bob Bennett, who is an incumbent and a Republican, and Newt Gingrich is supporting him. Members of the Club for Growth are against him because Bennett, though a Republican, voted in favor of the bank bailout and the, I believe, the stimulus as well. Gingrich still thinks he ought to be reelected and was criticizing the Club for Growth for not supporting conservative Republicans. And they came back and said, well, Gingrich is obviously a traditional Republican and we're conservative and principles are more important to us than party. So that ought to make Gingrich's attempt to become president all the more interesting. We talked about the fact that, by way of a headline, a traffic citation for having a dummy in her front seat. Fortunately, the last time my wife drove, and I was a passenger, that didn't happen, or she would have gotten a big ticket. But the dummy in this case was actually quite literally a mannequin. If you're into words, by the way, and I grant you're not trying to type a transcript of this show, but oddly, the word mannequin has become a one of those words, the spelling of which has changed. It used to be M-A-N-N-E-Q-U-I-N. If you attempt now to look up the word mannequin, you'll still find that, but you'll also find it spelled M-A-N-I-K-I-N, which strikes me as a dumbing down of the language, but maybe there's some other reason for it. Anyway, a woman, in order to get into the high-occupancy lane, high-occupancy vehicle lane, the diamond lane or whatever, in the state of New York, went ahead and put a mannequin's torso on her front seat and put sunglasses on it and then put the sun visor down on the passenger side so somebody wouldn't be readily able to see her mannequin. And conscientious, diligent police officer saw this and thought it odd that the passenger should be wearing sunglasses and have the sun visor down because it was a very cloudy day. And so he investigated further, found out that she had not a second passenger, but in fact a mannequin, or actually half a mannequin, it was just the torso and the face. And she went ahead. He went ahead and gave her a ticket. I don't know who to be more impressed by, the police officer for noticing this or the woman who was doing the driving for being so creative and a bit of a scofflaw, too. But she was, I guess she was in enough of a hurry that she thought this was a great idea. But there you have it. I'd like to, at this moment, make mention of the fact that we have a relatively new site for our book. I wrote a book called Mobile Millionaire, and it is a book about investing in mobile homes for profit and income. And it can now be found, it was on another site before, but it can now be found at mobilemillionaire, as if that were one word, .blogspot.com. And there is also an excerpt on that website, and best of all, an opportunity through PayPal to buy it, which some of you will actually want to do, but even if you don't, take a look at it. Look at the excerpt, see if you find that interesting. Newsoftheweird.com is a website which I recommend to you. It talks about, obviously, strange occurrences in the news, and I'm going to give you some of the samples we called from there in a moment. But I wanted to give out the phone number again. It's 347-994-3796. I'm going to repeat that because I'm not sure I said it correctly, so let me make sure I'm looking at it. 347-994-3796. The first item in the News of the Weird is the idea that was announced by the owner of a company called a restaurant called Mildred's Temple Kitchen. It's a restaurant in Toronto, extra points for any American who knows what province that's in. She had an unusual idea for celebrating Valentine's Day. Her name is Donna Duer. I just realized how funny that is. Donna Duer, D-O-O-H-E-R. You'll understand why that's funny in a moment. She suggests that a couple could have a nice dinner at the restaurant and follow it up by a romantic interlude in one of their four unisex bathrooms. Doher claims trysts have taken place in their restrooms before, but now she's encouraging people to do it, and she's employing a maid to keep things tidy during the Valentine weekend. And so, there was no picture on the website of what Donna looked like, so I don't know if she was going to permit you to do her that weekend. But anyway, the rest of the items certainly sounds interesting. That's in Toronto if you want to call and make your reservations. In another item, a 62-year-old man in Pontiac, Michigan, received second-degree burns to 18% of his body when his homemade sledding rocket, a rocket pack, exploded. The rocket pack was made from a motorcycle muffler. You're not going to believe the rest of this. That was filled with gasoline and gunpowder, giving new meaning to the phrase potent combination. After strapping it on to his body, he lit the fuse and began sledding down a hill in his backyard. Unfortunately, instead of it propelling him, which he probably was figuring on doing, and basically to go up like Rocket Man, the container with the gasoline and the gunpowder blew up and burned him. Now, every year this fella throws sledding parties in which he does stunts, and I sincerely hope he doesn't repeat that one. We're going to keep the promise we made about filibuster and cloture. And here's the reason why it's important. You know that Senator Scott Brown, now Senator Scott Brown, was sworn in today as the United States Senator from Massachusetts, replacing the late Edward Kennedy. With his swearing in, the Republicans have 41 members of the Senate, which means that by themselves, without the assistance of turncoat Democrats or undependable independents, but actually that was a repetition. I was referring in both cases to Joe Lieberman. But I could have also been making reference to certain members of the Senate who really are somewhat conservative and not dependable votes for the Democratic Party. Unless, of course, you want to give them things like Senator Nelson and Senator Landrieu. But anyway, the filibuster procedure used to be that if you wanted to essentially kill a bill in the Senate, you could just talk. You could hand it off to other members of your party or other people who agreed with you. But essentially, that was it. The situation was that you could talk until cloture were imposed, and cloture requires a vote. Until 1975, the cloture vote was two-thirds of those present. If two-thirds of those present voted to cut off debate, you were done. They changed it in 1975. And by the way, they did that change by a majority vote, and changed it so that it would take, instead of two-thirds, which is 66 2/3%, it would only take 60% to impose cloture. The difference was that instead of 60% of those present, it had to be 60 votes. So the problem is now you need 60 votes to pass anything, because otherwise someone will threaten a filibuster. They won't necessarily do it, but they'll threaten it, and that's enough to kill it. So you have to get 60 votes, which is almost impossible. This needs to be changed. My own opinion is it can be changed by majority rule, but there are some people who think that that would be subject to a filibuster as well. I believe we have joining us, and if so, that's great. If not, we have somebody from the same area code, I think, joining us. But I think if I can manage to do this, we have Rosella Rhine on the line. Are you there, Rosella?
I am here.
Hey. Oh, okay.
I'm here. Are you Jeff?
I am still, yes.
Yes, okay,
And we're together. In that case, let me give you a more eloquent introduction. Rosella Rhine, who is now on the phone with us, has published a number of articles on subjects not directly related to her book, but including interior design, volunteering, and environmental issues for newspapers in the San Francisco Bay Area, and she's written short stories And she was also in that same area, a very important part of making the Bay Area Rapid Transit System a reality. That goes back a few years. She's
yes, it
employed.
Does.
Yeah. how long is? Let's start there just for less. How long has BART actually been in place? How long has it been running?
Oh dear, do we have to really go back that far? It was.
Well, I remember. I'll confess, I remember it. I just don't remember the year.
It was on the ballot, which I worked on in 1962.
Wow.
And passed by a very slim majority, and
right.
was opened in 19, I believe it was 67 or 68, something around that time.
I would have guessed later, but yeah, but
yeah,
you know,
no.
I was yeah, I would have been a teenager.
You were just a babe. Yeah.
No. I was functional, more or less.
Oh, okay.
No less than now. And now you work for. An office in the Bay Area for a city in Northern California. You do some writing,
yeah,
and you all.
I just work part time for the city in which I live, for the volunteer office,
doing
okay. you know, press releases and that sort of thing.
Right, and you wrote a memoir called
yes,
"Life's a Pinata, Full of Surprises."
Exactly.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. But if while we're talking, you would wish to join us, you can do that at 347-994-3796. And if you don't want to join us, that's still the phone number, but you won't care nearly as much. Okay. Rosella,
yes.
you wrote this book, and it's essentially your life story. In brief, give us a brief overview of what Life's a Pinata Full of Surprises is all about. Well, first off, not everybody lives in California. I know this may sound stupid, but probably not everybody knows what a pinata is. Go ahead and tell them.
Oh, well, a pinata is actually, people have said to me, are you Mexican? And I said, no, I'm very Italian, because the pinata, although I don't know where it originated, but it is a straw thingy, what can I say, that they put at parties for kids to hit with a stick,
right.
and when they hit it with a stick, all these great surprises fall out. And,
right. Money.
Yeah, the title came from a line in the book, Jeff. It was
mm-hmm.
it was a time in my life where a husband who had been gone for many years appeared at a party for his son and offered to do all these great and glorious things. And I was so amazed and astounded, I said to myself, wow, this is better than a pinata at a birthday party or something to that effect. and that's how the title came about.
Okay, now, and so give us a brief synopsis or idea of what someone can expect to read about when they buy your book, which, by the way, is available at Amazon.com. Go ahead.
It's available at more than Amazon.com. It's available at Barnes & Noble's, at iUniverse, who was the publishing company. It's available at any bookstore. They just have to go in and ask
right.
for it. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I read a New York article, it was in the New York Magazine recently,
mm-hmm.
and the title is wonderful. It's called "But Enough About Me," and it's all about. I know, isn't it a great title? It's about the
yeah.
popularity of memoirs these days, and apparently
oh, yeah.
that for in modern history, it's been the black sheep of the literary family. You
right.
know, like the drunken guest at a wedding that constantly mortifies its. Sober relatives by embarrassing
yeah.
them with all these secrets, right? Okay, well,
that used
I thought
to be what
that.
The memoir was considered, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. In fact, I think it was Freud thought it was very narcissistic to write a memoir, which maybe it is. But anyhow, my introduction said that it's my memoir, and it's written by an ordinary woman, nobody, you know, who's done anything sensational, but it's for all women who journey forth through life, courageously one day, tentatively the next, and sometimes veer off course. And it was inspired by a woman I met recently who had been devastated by a divorce and a betrayal and thought her life was over. And I thought, gosh, you know, her life isn't over. I mean, I've been through that a lot more, and I've survived, more than survived. So I thought
right,
it might
right.
be a little bit inspirational. That may be sound kind of, you know, narcissistic, but anyway. That's kind of
no,
my feeling.
Yeah, no, it's not narcissistic when you have overcome adversity, and you don't have to become like Donald Trump or name someone else who's notoriously successful most of the time. It's not like
you do
that, but the fact that you have overcome that adversity and managed to succeed on a number of levels is in fact inspirational. And it's it's a question of whether someone wants to take that out of it. But the fact is, it does inspire, and I think that that's undoubtedly a service.
Well, that's what I was hoping.
Yeah.
And you know, it's interestingly enough that most memoirs that are written by women my age, and don't ask me my age, please. But
I wouldn't
most
think of it.
I know you win. Most women or people who write memoirs, they do it for their family. You know, this is, I want my family. Well, frankly, I was a little afraid to have my family read it. I waited a long time to write it because most of the people I wrote it about are dead. And I thought, well, that's pretty safe. You know?
Yeah, right. They won't make their objections known to you.
No, that's right. Yeah, or sue me.
Yeah. That's even better. So you mentioned you're very Italian. You actually lived in Italy for a time, did you not?
Yes, I did. I moved over there a couple years after my last husband died, and I had always, it was in my bucket list of things to do, as was the memoir. I had always wanted to publish a book and live in a foreign country, and because Italy was the country of my ancestry, I thought, what better place than Italy? And it was really a year that's indescribable.
I was about to ask you how long that was for, and you just said it was a year.
It was for a year, yeah. Yeah.
Was there any reason you only made it for a year? I made it. Is there some reason you chose to live there only for a year, or was that the original plan?
It was the original plan. I had just had two grandsons born, and I didn't want to miss out on their childhood, their babyhood.
Right.
And besides, I had, which is not in my memoir, I had written a book while I was over there. It was a novel, but in retrospect, I realized it was a memoir that I, hid in this novel.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to get home to see if I could get it published. And that's what
is that the book? Is that the book that ultimately became Life?
No. It was a novel, as I say, and really a hidden memoir. Because it was a lot of it based on my life. And I was, at that time, which was in 1993, I was afraid, frankly, to be too open. You know what I'm saying? I mean,
right,
I think a lot of people who write memoirs do this. But I just thought, this is not me. I was writing it in a different way. So anyway,
third person about a character, yeah.
Yeah, I tried to get it published. I sent it to some agents, and I got a good response about my writing, but they wanted me to make some changes. And I was at that point, I lived with it for a year, and I was sick of it, and I didn't want to do any more with it. So I put it aside, and then, 20 years later, wrote this memoir.
Which was really the book your subconscious
was really
probably
the
trying
book
to write.
I wanted, yes, which was really the book I wanted to write in the first place, but, didn't. And that is why, before you have a chance to ask me, Jeff, is why I self-published. Because, it's really difficult to get published by a good publishing house when you're an unknown author.
Sure. And it's something like, there's a joke about if you're a single woman and older than 40, your chances of getting remarried are roughly akin to being stricken by lightning.
I didn't have that problem.
I understand, but I'm saying, that's the joke. And so when you're talking about self-publishing, when you're talking about getting published as an unknown author by a major publishing house, the odds are probably slightly worse.
Yeah, and they've gotten worse in the last few years. I think.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know that much about the publishing business, but it seems to me they've gotten a lot worse. Yeah, and at this stage of my life, I mean, I didn't want to wait, 2-3 years to have somebody first accept it and then take another 2 or 3 years to publish it. I mean, I thought, no, this has to be done soon.
And how's the book doing?
Well, actually, it's done pretty well. I mean, I can't gauge it on anything because it's my first book, but I've sold several hundred, and No, I'm doing okay. I think I need a lot. The marketing aspect is almost, well, I know it's not almost, it's harder than writing it, you know, and I'm not
sure.
A marketing person, but it's tough. It's really tough to get out there and market yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm. Have you had the opportunity, I mean, we're changing from the book and talking about the business of publishing and selling your books, but have you had the opportunity to do speaking engagements and that kind of thing, or has it been some other process that you've gone through?
No, I have one coming up for a book club, but do you know that, and I just found this out the other day, that to do a book signing at a bookstore, they now charge
uh-huh.
you between $300 and $500? I didn't know that.
And I didn't, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I'm not either,
because,
considering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because
yeah.
they see it as them giving you an opportunity in a location.
Right. Right.
And, you know, and the truth is, in terms of a signing, you run into the same kind of situation to some degree, which is if you're unknown, you're not going to attract a large audience, and people who happen
exactly.
to be in the bookstore at the time, you know, may
exactly.
hang out. But you have to do something really unusual in order to sell enough books to more than make back your $300 to $500
exactly.
donations
exactly.
or whatever.
Yeah.
Exactly. You mentioned your late husband. That was Bill, correct?
That was Bill. Uh huh.
Okay. And what it was it after he passed away that you had gone to Italy? You were on your own there?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a couple, 2-3 years after he died that I decided. As I say, I had this. You know it sounds like a cliche and kind of corny, but this bucket list of things I wanted to do, I had done most of them except living abroad and having a book published. And
mm-hmm.
so I decided, you know, I learned from his illness and death that, you know, life's too short to wait for anything. So I better hurry up and do whatever I wanted to do. And I did. Yeah.
You met and married not when you were kids, but actually when you were what's an appropriate word? You were at a more mature point in your lives, correct?
You mean this third time around charm husband that I talked about?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah, I did. I met him after a couple of catastrophes, let's say, but a lot of learning went into it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean I think that's the focus of the book, really, is that all these strange, unusual things I did. When I look around at my contemporaries now and I see married couples, they've all been married 40, 50, 60 years. They've lived in the
right.
same house for 40 years. And I think, gosh, you know, I'm really weird because I've had several husbands. I've moved 35 times. I've, you know, lived from... Are you laughing at this?
I laughed at 35 times. I'll share with you why in a moment. Go ahead with what you were saying.
Well, anyway, and you know, and I just thought, gee, you know, I guess I'm not as normal as other people who grew up in my era. You know what I mean? I mean, I grew up in an era where you were kind of preordained to have one husband and a couple of kids, and you live in the suburbs, and that's it, you know. And
yeah.
I didn't live that kind
yeah.
of life. Yeah.
Right. I don't think I've lived in 35 places, but there was a period in my life when I was married in my disastrous first marriage that within 2.5 years we moved 5 times.
Oh, God, yeah. You're worse than I am.
Well, only in that short period. I mean, and the we've lived where we are now about 6, and the place before that we lived in one place for like 14 years. So that's not only unusual, but it'll give you an idea that I've got a few years on me too.
Oh yeah, but 14 years, I've never lived any place 14 years. So anyway, as I say, that's one of the things that kind of compelled me to write the book too. Is I thought, you know, I don't know. I guess my life is a little different than the ordinary person my age. I mean, you know, I'm sure that the kids today look at life differently, but we didn't in those days.
Well, you were ahead of your time.
I must have been. I always thought that I was really born too late. I mean, you know, like when I grabbed onto the 60s and the meditation and the yoga and the women's lib, I thought, wow, why wasn't I in this in the beginning, you know? But anyway,
sure.
I caught up.
Sure.
I caught up. I grabbed onto the tail end of it and I caught up.
I understand. Did I understand, too, that you were contemplating or you are, in fact, writing another book?
Well, I think I spoke to Sabrina, you know, the publicity lady I used,
right.
And I was thinking of a murder mystery because I'm a great fan of murder mysteries. I read them all. I love them all. But, yeah, I am writing another book, but it's actually what it is. It's going to be letters that were I wrote when I was living in Italy, and I'm going to just take the letters and comprise them into a book.
How many, is it going to come out as a book of letters, or is it going
it's
to be...
It's going to come out as more of a travel book, you know, extolling the beauties of this particular area I lived in Italy, which you don't hear about. It's not like, you know, that Under the Tuscany Sun or
right.
Umbria or these places. This is an area on the Italian Riviera, and it's Ligurian Sea, which is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. And you don't hear a lot about it. And I thought I would like to describe it and promote it and maybe, you know, write this book as a travel book or something.
Yeah, you would be inclined to self-publish that as well?
Well, I don't know. That's a tedious process. Probably I will end up doing that. I don't know. You know, it's just, it's self-publishing is tough and expensive.
Well, since we've gotten onto that and we've touched upon it a couple of times, let's talk for a minute about what that process is.
Yeah.
After you've written the book, because there are people who listen to the show, I mean, at least one or two people altogether, but one of those two.
My friend.
Well, one of your friends and one of mine. That's the entire audience. But seriously, the subject of writing is of some interest. And I've discussed this on the show before. The computer has the advantage of making creation of content easy. It has
mm-hmm.
the disadvantage of convincing anyone who knows how to type think they know
mm-hmm.
how to write. Let's leave
mm-hmm.
that aside. When you're talking about self-publishing, describe the process, if you will. First thing is, of course, it's kind of like making chicken soup. First you go catch the chicken. But in this case,
yeah, right.
first you write the book. What happens then in terms of the process of publishing?
Well, it was interesting. I've said to people, when I got the first hard copy, and I don't mean to digress from what you're saying, I'll come back to
That's
it.
Right,
but when I got the first hard copy, I mean soft copy of the book, I thought it was like giving birth. Because it took me
mm-hmm.
5 months to write it and 4 months to get it published, which was quite
right.
interesting. But anyway, I just decided I was going to self-publish, and I never had thought I would because, I mean, I think a memoir is kind of a narcissistic trip anyway. But I just thought if I'm going to get this out there in print, I've got to self-publish. There's no way I can wait for especially a memoir, you know. Anyway. So I went on websites and I looked them up and I found a website that said that this particular publisher, and I don't think I need to mention the name, said it was probably the best in the business and it
uh-huh.
could get the book out in 3 to 4 months. So I thought, wow, that's for me. So I signed up with them and, you know, went through the process of paying them what they wanted and all that business. And it worked out. In some instances, it worked out fine. Their graphics were beautiful. I love the cover. I love the way they set up the book, you know, on the front cover. Mm-hmm. I had trouble with the editing aspect of it. But maybe
right.
that happens in all. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that happens in every self-published company.
When you say you had trouble with the editing aspect of it, this particular publishing / printing company, they went ahead and did editing for you as part of their price?
Well, no, you pay for each step of the editing, line editing, proofreading, all things that actually I have done on my own for various jobs I've worked on. I probably could have done it myself, but when you're self-publishing
right.
your own book, you don't feel comfortable doing that. So I paid for all these different things, and I just had trouble with their line editing, which I almost paid $2,000 for, came back with most of the corrections were turning the straight quotes into curly quotes.
Okay.
You get what I'm saying?
You're talking about the way that they're printed. You had just made them, you're talking
yeah.
about the quotation marks. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And that started the whole process off. But anyway, that was kind of a difficult time trying to get the editing done the way I wanted it to. But in the end, it turned out okay. You know, I like the cover, and the book is printed the way I wanted it. And, you know, there were just glitches, okay. And maybe you run into those with a big publishing house. I don't know.
Most writers who I've talked to who have gone with large publishing houses are devastated by editing.
Because is that right?
But then it's a case of, not that I've talked to that many, but then it tends to be a case where the editors wanted to change the book in such a way that it mm-hmm. wasn't just something that was minor in terms of the way that quotations were put in there, quotation marks in your case, or the way that something was stylistically. They wanted to make enormous changes, and then they had to fight it each step of the way.
Well, that's what I ran into, Jeff.
Go ahead.
Jeff, that's what I ran into with the book I wrote in Italy. They wanted me, they were very complimentary about the writing and blah, 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 but they wanted me to take a subplot, which was a mystery, and make it the main plot because they said mystery sold better. You know?
Yeah, there's a play out now that you just reminded me of. It's called I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change.
Well, you know, that's hard to do when you write the book for a purpose and they want you suddenly to change the whole premise of the book. I mean, anyway.
Sure.
So, yeah,
sure.
I can understand
so
that.
Anyway,
so,
go ahead with what you were saying about the process.
No, go ahead.
Publishing. No, I was asking you to go ahead.
That's about it.
Okay. And then once you had it printed, how did you do this by yourself or did the publisher do it for you, which I doubt? But how did you get it into bookstores? Because you're in a lot of bookstores.
We're talking about the marketing aspect now.
Right.
Oh, that's tough. This was published on November 20th of last year, and I'm still struggling with that. It's really tough. It's really tough. I think they being the publisher, has, is it Ingram is the distributor? You probably
yeah,
know better
Yeah, Ingram is
than
a distributor of books
Ingram.
And software, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's another one. I don't have it in front of me right now, but
that's
there
right.
are two that are distributors, and apparently they do distribute, and I've had people go to Barnes Nobles and ask for the book, and they will order it for them, and they'll get it in a week or two.
So it's basically with distributors, and it's not so much in bookstores like on the shelves next to John Grisham's latest book, but people can get it through those bookstores.
No, that's right. It's not on the bookshelves, and that's what I'm trying to do now. You know, if I have to go door-to-door, or I should say store-to-store with my book, I will. I just signed up with an email organization, and they sent out 15,000 emails, and within 2 days, I got 8 requests for books for review now. Yeah, for review, which is good.
Yeah.
I need the reviews. And actually, one in Little Rock, Arkansas, within a day of mailing the book, I had a review on Amazon.com, which was nice,
That's great.
So that may work out okay. But I'd love to get it on the shelves, you know. I just would love to see it on the shelves, yeah. And that's the hard part.
If you ever do that, you're going to be able to write a book on marketing books. And the reason I say that, and there are people who know more about this than I do. In fact, almost any, this is not my business in terms of publishing. But I will tell you that from what I've heard and read, and I've been, like you, I've been writing for years. But one of the things that I've read is a self-published book getting on the shelves in a bookstore. Mm-hmm. Is slightly less likely than being a woman over 40.
No,
that's because I was going to build on the extremely small odds. Who gets remarried while lightning strikes her as she's publishing her book. But, it's very hard to get into the stores. The fact that you've been able to get with the distributors is obviously, part of the process and it's great.
Someone has
to know about your book.
In looking at the grand scheme of things, the way bookstores are doing today, and they're not doing all that great from what I've been hearing, the fact that it's on Amazon and it's on Barnes & Noble and it's on several other online sites, I think, if people want to get on their computer and buy it, that's great. I would love to see it on a bookshelf. I mean, it's just part of being a writer. Is seeing it on a bookshelf.
Oh, absolutely. It's not so much, it would be wonderful if it sold 100,000 copies and you made a lot of money. But the fact is that what you really want in large part is if you write a book, you're writing it to be read.
That's right. You know,
you want, yeah.
Yeah, my son said to me one day, "Mom, you didn't write this book to make money, did you?" I said, "Well, no, not really. But it would be nice, you know."
Yeah, but primarily you want to be read because there's something in there, you had something to say.
Exactly, Jeff. That's the thing. I had something to say when I wrote it, and I'd like people to read it and have the chance to read it.
Yeah. I have a strange question for you, because you've made reference a couple of times to the bucket list, and for those who don't know what a bucket list is, first of all, since we have a couple of minutes, tell everybody what a bucket list is, first of all.
Well, I'm sure if anybody saw the movie with, I think it was Walter Matthau, and I forget who the other one was.
Actually, it was Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman.
Was it? Anyway, I didn't see the movie.
Yeah.
I had this long before the movie came out. It's just a list of things you want to do before you die, and I've had it for years and years, and it was, you know, play a musical instrument and learn a foreign language and live abroad and write a book that's published, and I've been working my way through those until I got to living abroad and writing the book and published the book. And I hate to think that maybe I'm at the end of the bucket list now.
Well, I was about to ask you, what's left on your list, if anything?
I got to throw a few more things in there to keep me going. But anyway, that's what the bucket list is. It's goals, you know. I mean, basically, they're just goals that you want to reach before you leave this earth. That's all.
Yeah. Well, and the movie, which I don't think was a big hit.
No, it wasn't.
Really was. Yeah, actually, it was, you know, and I don't know that I'm equipped to make this judgment, but it really was kind of I hate to use the word because it sounds phony, but it was really kind of a spiritual movie.
I didn't see it,
yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, and if you say that about a movie with Jack Nicholson, that immediately sounds ludicrous. But it really
yes, it does.
but it really was, and of course Morgan Freeman is a very deep, you know, actor as well as human. It's just it talks about the things you want to accomplish, and it shows this character in terms of Nicholson, the change that overtakes him as he's dying and knows he's dying, and he's going to do these things before he goes, and how he comes into contact with Freeman and all, you know, Freeman's character and all the stuff that happens. It really is a pretty philosophical, deep, spiritual movie, and, you know, and I'm sure that people who are listening who saw the movie may disagree with me, but I think
on some level everybody has a bucket list. They may not call it that, they may not even know they have it, but I think that almost everyone has something in their heart or soul that they think, gee, I'd really like to do that before I leave this earth, you know what I mean? Yeah. Well, I mean, mine were very concrete things, and they were things I felt I could accomplish. And,
apparently you were right.
Yeah. I feel pretty good about the bucket.
Yeah. I understand. I am interested in going back for a moment to your being involved with BART. What did you actually do with Bay Area Rapid Transit? You're not still
well,
with them. You're working for a city now.
Oh, no. They've been running along very smoothly without me for many,
right.
many years. I started with them actually because I worked on their bond campaign. They were on the proposition on the ballot in 1962, and I helped pass. Well, I didn't do it, but I mean, I was part of the campaign, and we passed it. And then, because of my experience on the campaign, they asked me to come work for BART. And I thought, oh gosh, what a dull job that's going to be, working for a railroad, because I'd been in advertising and I'd been in the fashion world for a while. And I thought, I needed a job. I was raising a son by myself, so I took the job, and it turned out to be the most exciting job I'd ever had. I mean, I met two presidents, you know, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, and not that I'm excited about either one of them, but at least I met them, and I took them on tours, and we had senators, and we had people from all over the world, because we were a renaissance transit system. We were the first one since the New York subway, which was built in like 1900 or something. So we attracted a lot of outsiders, And it turned, and I was in the public relations department eventually, and
oh,
which put me in a good spot. So I did a lot of the tours, and you know, and then I became assistant to the general manager. And anyway, it was just, it turned out to be a fabulous, fabulous, exciting job. And we got it rolling. We got the thing rolling, and it's been a, you know, with all the criticism we took and all the troubles we had, because, you know, any big project that has a lot of political entities, it had a lot of, you know, trials and tribulations. It's running, and when we had our Loma Prieta earthquake here in 1992, whatever it was, that was the thing that kept this. Yeah, that's the system that kept this place running, because all the other, you know, systems were down. So anyway, I'm very proud of it. I'm very proud that I was part of it.
Yeah, and I need to explain a little bit further in what you said in terms of that earthquake. That was the earthquake that took place during the World Series in the Bay Area.
Yes,
and,
yes, my son was at the World Series. Yeah,
I was there.
Were you here?
And the, No. I'm trying to remember. I was already here where I am. I'm in the Phoenix area.
Ah.
And when that took place, and I'm saying this not to tell you, but to tell the people in our audience who are not familiar with the occurrences, getting around the Bay Area by car was virtually impossible.
Oh, impossible,
The only thing that
The Bay Bridge had dropped into the sea, you know. I mean, it was awful, and BART still kept running. So for all our critics, at the time we were building it, I wanted to, you know, accost them and say, see?
As a matter of fact, and the same thing happened. I used to live in L.A., but I was long gone by then. I think it was 94, they had an earthquake in the, which was
Northridge.
Centered in Northridge, right.
Really?
And in fact, the similar thing happened. Everybody who was against all of the rail that they had put in were now using it, because it was not quite the only way to get around, but it was one of the only ways to get around, because Interstate 5, which was running through, you know, a good portion of California, or the L.A. area, and obviously it runs all the way up the country, the west side of the country, that was basically the only way to get around, so again.
Well,
same kind of situation.
Jeff, I don't know if you've read Life's a Pinata, Full of Surprises, but my husband, the final husband, the great husband, was the general manager of that system.
Oh,
he ran that. He started that system, and he ran it, and yes, that was his baby. He was a native of. Pardon me.
I met him
at BART. He was one of our engineers at BART, and then through them, there's a long story, and you have to read the book to get it all.
Right.
But eventually, his final job was as general manager of the Metro Rail down there in L.A. And,
okay. I didn't understand that. Okay, yeah. And
yeah,
Metro
yeah.
Rail went in after I moved away from Los Angeles, but I have used it since I've gone back.
Yeah, yeah. And
it's a great system.
Apparently, it's a great system. Yeah, that's what I hear. Yeah.
Let me mention the book and how people can get it. Again, there are a couple of different ways, and if I miss something, you fill it in. The book's title is Life's a Pinata, Full of Surprises, using the punctuation mark, not the word colon. That's a whole other book. and you can get it at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, which is also BN.com, I think, and iUniverse. And in any major and several minor bookstores.
Yeah, and everywhere fine books are sold. And I noticed that on my press release it says Baker and Taylor.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. I thought maybe it was an Eastern.
I don't either, but I thought you might know. I think it's a distributor.
Might be. I was going to say, I thought it might be like a regional book chain somewhere where neither you nor I have lived.
I think it and Ingram and Baker and Taylor are distributors. So anyway, anybody who's interested can try that too. But definitely Amazon.com.
And I'm sure somebody could just put into Google Life and Pinata and thereby find the book and obtain it. And go ahead.
I did that the other day and found it over in Australia. So, if any of you are listening, yes.
We're on the internet, so it's available anywhere.
That's
the show. So, and which reminds me, any of your friends who you didn't get to before the show can listen to how wonderful you were in archive fashion.
Okay.
Okay. By the way, so what I was going to say about the book, for those of you who wish to know this, it is in paperback, and it's 288 pages. So besides being a fast read because of the fact that it's well written, it'll also be a fast read for you because it's not War and Peace. It's 288
pages. It's a great book to take on a trip, on an airplane trip, or to put yourself to sleep at night, okay?
There you go. Now, the in your memoir, by the way, you also go through the story of your earlier less than happy marriages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was it the second husband who was the John Edwards model?
No, that was the first one.
The second one was the one
with all the dollar signs in front of his name.
Ah.
You should have read the book, Jeff. I'm telling you.
No. Actually, I've just been able to ascertain some things here in terms of preparing to discuss this with you, because I want people to have a taste of what the book is like, because I think it's important that people, and frankly, not just women, but especially women, be encouraged to read your book, because I think it is a case of you've been through a lot. You have, as I said earlier, you've overcome a lot, and I think it's important that people realize that. By the way, in the last few minutes we have remaining, I should share with you. Oh, actually, we're going to have to run, but I just want to share with you. We share a couple of favorite authors in common, one of which was Michael Conley. I will end there because we have our endpoint essay editorial to go through. It's been wonderful. Yeah, please.
I want to say one final thing, that the book has poignant moments, but it also has a lot of humor in it. So, you know, it's not a real downer. It is kind of fun to read, too.
Right, like the author, great humor.
I thank you, Jeff, for this time.
Thank you very much. It was really fun.
And
for me, too. Thanks very much for joining us, and it was great.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay.
All right, Rosella, thanks. Bye-bye. And we are still here, and again, that's Rosella Rhine. The book is Life's a Pinata Full of Surprises. In the 2 minutes remaining, if I can make it, we're going to give you our endpoint essay called Don't Ask. And if we don't finish, we'll start the whole thing again next week. Some polls have been taken recently trying to determine the attitude of those serving in our military regarding the president's plan to allow gays and lesbians to serve openly in the military. Generally speaking, serving openly means they don't have to hide who they are or what they do, although there may be restrictions on displays of affection, like there are with straight soldiers, sailors, and Marines. The polling that's been reported suggests that a majority of the members of our military would prefer that gays and lesbians remain, for lack of a better word, closeted. And I don't care. I don't mean I don't care whether gays are allowed to serve without keeping secret the fact they're gay. I mean I don't care what the present members of our armed forces think. While I'm sorry if that seems insensitive, let's think about it. The military is not a democracy, and nor should it be. In fact, this society is not a democracy. If it were, does anyone think slavery would have ended in the South when it did? When the case was decided that said it was unconstitutional to deny the right for people to get married, with one member of the couple was white and the other was black, the majority of the American public was against that decision, as they were Brown versus Board of Education. Most relevant is what happened in 1946. Harry Truman ordered all military activities and living quarters to be integrated. African Americans would no longer be restricted, and most members of the military were against that change, as most are probably against the change proposed by the current president. They're wrong, and what they think doesn't matter, because today Truman's proven right. And when the policy is implemented that ends this nonsensical period, so will President Obama. Thank you for joining us. I want to thank our wonderful producer, Autumn Leaves Bushman, and I hope you join us next week. Among other things, we'll have as a guest an author who has written about the Kennedy assassination and the Warren Commission and all the evidence that developed since then. You'd honor us if you joined us. Thank you, and have a great week.